have a question for Stone Cold.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, first of all, Stone Cold and I really like your style, the no-nonsense approach to wrestling. I think you could go far, except for one thing. I mean, what's with the swearing all the time? I think it kind of indicates a lack of creativity, a lack of imagination, and I think it'll hinder you in your future here in the WWF.
I think if you keep talking to me like that, and if you're in person here, I might hinder your life.
Welcome to episode 150 of The Sound Off here on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, March 13th, 2011. I am the Solemn Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast on this, the 150th installment of this show. It's kind of another benchmark here that we have reached. And, again, wouldn't be possible without everybody listening, so I want to just send a quick thank you to everybody who has downloaded this and many of the other shows that I have done. And here's to episode 200, which is not all that far around the corner. Good to be back here in New York after a couple of days of R&R down in Florida. I want to thank everybody who sent me notes wishing me a safe voyage to and from. I appreciate that. The only bad part of the whole trip was really the travel back. I hit a five-hour flight delay on Thursday night, which wasn't too fun, but thankfully, my iPhone kept me entertained, as did your comments on Twitter. So, I want to thank everybody for that. Got to check out some New York Mets spring training baseball games down in Port St. Lucie at Digital Domain Park, the former Tradition Field, which was actually a very nice little stadium. I think it fits about 7,500 people. And it was good times. You know, I got to meet some of the players, some of the members of the team. The new Mets manager, Terry Collins, who could not be a nicer guy and has such a tan that it just depressed the hell out of me. This guy's tan is one of the best tans perhaps I've ever seen anybody have in the history of mankind. So, anyway, good times. And you know, as far as the Mets are concerned, let's just hope that they can put something together this season, have a good 2011, and build for 2012 and beyond. So, I was able to check out Raw on Monday night, so I want to talk about that in a little bit. SmackDown as well, which I was able to check out on YouTube. I do like that WWE posts the full episodes of SmackDown in HD on YouTube, so I was able to check out all the little bits and pieces of that show. We'll talk a little bit of NXT as well, and some other stuff. But the first thing I want to do here is just make mention of a story that I'm sure pretty much everybody listening is aware of. If you're not, then you should be, because the big story of the week, or of the last several days, was the massive earthquake that struck Japan a couple of days ago. 8.9 magnitude quake, which again, on the Richter scale, 10 is the highest. So to hit roughly a 9, that's no laughing matter right there. And hundreds, if not thousands, of people dead, missing. I know we have at least some listeners in Japan, some of whom write into me fairly often and are followers on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, and I haven't been able to check in with any of those people as of yet, but I certainly hope that you know, anybody who listens to this show who lives in Japan or comes from Japan is hopefully okay. And I guess anything that anybody can do to help out with any of the relief efforts, I know the information is out there. Just the footage of when the earthquake hit, you know, there was some footage of people in office buildings and whatnot, and unless you've actually been involved in something like that, there's absolutely no way to describe what that must be like. And there was a tsunami, of course, subsequent to the earthquake, as is usually the case in a situation like this. Just the loss of life is just horrible. And you know, Japan is, I've never been to Japan myself, but I know people who have been there, and of course, in terms of pro wrestling, Japan is one of the great places in the world. You know, the Japanese wrestling scene may not be what it used to be, but it's always been quite revered, and I know a lot of the Japanese groups, you know, Dragon Gate and Pro Wrestling Noah, and I think All Japan, that have had events scheduled. I think a lot of those events have been canceled or postponed, you know, so hopefully things can get back to normal in short order, but they're still really, you know, just really suffering down there, and hopefully all will work out on that front. So I just wanted to make mention of that up front and hope that everybody is okay. So before we get into the wrestling news here, I just want to talk about the big story in pro wrestling and MMA this past weekend. which actually did not break until yesterday, late morning, early afternoon, and that was the purchase of the Strikeforce MMA promotion by UFC. UFC President Dana White did a 20-minute sit-down interview with reporter Ariel Helwani going over the details, or at least as much in the way of details as he could provide about the sale, what it's going to mean for the future, and a lot of people getting very excited initially when they hear this news that this is going to be great for the MMA sport. It's going to result in dream matches pitting UFC guys against Strikeforce guys and all this other stuff. And at least initially up front, it does not appear that that will be the case. According to Dana White, it's going to be business as usual. They have retained Scott Coker, who of course was part owner of Strikeforce and pretty much the booking force for years now behind the promotion. They've been in competition with Dana and UFC, but Dana likes Scott Coker. Apparently he's going to be kept on to continue to book and run business as usual in Strikeforce, just as though there had been no sale. So that will not change. Dana says that he is intent on honoring existing contracts, so anybody who is a contracted Strikeforce fighter will continue to compete for Strikeforce until their deal is up, I guess, in which case Dana would be free himself to negotiate with that person to bring them into the UFC. Or I suppose they could still negotiate with Scott Coker if they want to stay with Strikeforce. So it sounds to me, at least initially, the plan is to run it as a separate promotion, as though nothing has changed except for the fact that ownership now falls under the Zuffa umbrella. Zuffa is the parent company, of course, that also runs the UFC. Frank and Lorenzo Fertitta, the Fertitta brothers, are owners of UFC along with Dana White, as well as Abu Dhabi. There is a sports group based out of Abu Dhabi that bought, I think, a 10% stake in UFC about a year or two ago. No plans to merge at this point. Now, of course, we've heard this before. UFC did purchase the WEC, the World Extreme Cage Fighting Promotion, many years ago, and continued to run it separately. You know, WEC had their own employees that ran that brand. They had their own TV shows on the Versus Network. They continued to operate independent of UFC. And of course, what ended up happening was UFC wanted the lighter weight classes for the UFC promotion. And in December, WEC ran their final show, and they were absorbed into the UFC. My gut tells me that within the next 2 or 3 years, the same thing is likely to happen with Strikeforce. And what makes this even more interesting, to use a pro wrestling analogy here, this deal, this announcement, comes exactly 10 years to the month that WWE purchased or announced their intent to purchase World Championship Wrestling. It was March of 2001 when the deal was struck for Vince McMahon to essentially purchase the assets of what was once the number one wrestling promotion in the country and in the world. You know, WCW at its peak was pretty much kicking all kinds of ass. Their time at the top was fairly limited before they took an unbelievable nosedive. And of course, the promotion died a death. But it's kind of interesting to draw parallels between the two, because when WWF initially purchased WCW, the plan was, for many months, the plan was to continue running WCW as a separate promotion under the WWE umbrella. And Vince McMahon and you know, Jim Ross and all the executives were having brainstorm sessions and meetings for months planning how this was going to work. You know, WCW was going to have its own TV show in its own time slot once a week, and they were going to be booked completely separate from the WWF product. And you know, again, Jim Ross was involved in a lot of these meetings, and that was the plan. And as many of you are well aware, there was a Raw episode from Tacoma, Washington, which I want to say was in June of 2001. And it featured, they were doing a WCW main event. So they even brought in Scott Hudson, the former WCW play-by-play guy, and Arn Anderson. In the final segment of this particular Raw episode, they came in to announce what was being billed as a WCW Championship main event on Raw. And Booker T was the defending champion at the time, and he was defending the belt against Buff Bagwell. And this match was the match as it turned out, that would drive the final stake in the heart of the WCW brand. The crowd just completely crapped all over the match. The match itself was obviously nothing special, but it was the crowd reaction, or the crowd indifference to that match, that really made Vince McMahon do a complete 180. Vince McMahon was watching backstage. He was appalled by what he was seeing and what he was hearing. And in that moment, he decided, you know what? We're done with WCW. We're not going to do this. We're not going to waste our time if people are not going to get behind the brand. And essentially, he killed those plans dead. And he just absorbed many of the WCW lower and mid-card guys onto the WWE roster. And all plans to run it as a separate promotion were dropped. And I'm not saying the same thing is going to happen here with UFC and Strikeforce. In fact, I think I take Dana White at his word when he says that it's going to be business as usual, at least for the next 6 months to a year. We're not going to see super fights. We're not going to see, you know, a mixing of the two brands. It's going to pretty much be kept separate. And at some point, that I'm sure is going to change. But if you are an MMA fan and are excited about the potential of some sort of, you know, WrestleMania-type supercard, don't get your hopes up so fast. You know, when it comes to fighters like Alistair Overeem and Fedor Emelianenko and guys like that, they are under Strikeforce contract, and they're not going to be coming over to the UFC, at least not anytime in the near future. But nonetheless, this is huge. I mean, this is, again, very similar to WWF and WCW in that WCW at the end was dying a death. They were a distant number two. They had a huge fall from grace, but they were still the de facto number two pro wrestling organization in the world. And Vince McMahon scooped up and bought his competition for a paltry sum. I've heard $2.5 million. I've heard $5 million. Whatever it was, at its peak, WCW was worth a hell of a lot more than that. And Vince McMahon got a steal on that deal and bought his competition. And in this case, Strikeforce was absolutely nowhere near the level of UFC. It was not making money like UFC. It was not anywhere close to being at the level that UFC is at. But it was the de facto number two, and still is the de facto number two MMA organization, at least in this country. I won't say the world, but certainly in the U.S., in North America. And Dana White and the his fellow owners of UFC, they went in, they made a deal. Apparently, Strikeforce was looking to make a deal, and they had gotten at least one solid offer, apparently of about $40 million. Dana White would not say how much the deal was for, but apparently the deal was better than the $40 million offer that Strikeforce initially received, so I would guess perhaps $50 million. I know that UFC paid about $65 million for the rights many years ago to the Pride Fighting Organization, which at one time was the number one MMA group in the world, based out of Japan. And again, Pride as well. Pride lost their TV deal, I believe. They had a tremendous fall from grace. And essentially, UFC picked the bones, but they still spent $65 million to buy Pride and the Pride trademarks and all of that. And I'm not so sure that that was a good deal for UFC to make in hindsight. I don't know that they paid quite as much for Strikeforce, but again, the de facto number two organization, their primary competitor. You know, they have TV on the Showtime cable network. And they made an offer that I guess the Strikeforce folks could not refuse, and the deal was consummated. So this is a very big story. It will have reverberations around the MMA world for some time to come. Is it a good deal or not for the fighters? Again, to go back to pro wrestling, was it good when WWF bought WCW in that a lot of the wrestlers no longer had the leverage to negotiate with another wrestling organization to kind of play the WWF against WCW? Probably not such a good thing for the wrestlers. I'm not so sure it's such a good thing for the fighters either, because again, the two are very similar. Wrestling and MMA are very different, but they also share a lot of similarities, and I just thought it was almost eerie when I first heard of this deal when the news broke yesterday. Again, considering it's 10 years to the month of the WCW purchase, and I would suggest, as a fan, hindsight being 2020, the death of WCW and WWF buying WCW, even though they've done some great things in terms of capitalizing on the video library and stuff, and putting together, you know, video packages and DVDs, the best of Nitro, what, you know, that's all well and good, but I'm not so sure that in hindsight that purchase and just the death of that promotion was such a good thing for the pro wrestling industry, which, quite frankly, has never really recovered from that. You know, it's never quite gotten back to those peaks. Business has been up the last several weeks because The Rock is back. It's WrestleMania season. But, it, you know, after WrestleMania, I'm sure it'll be business as usual for WWE as well. Business ain't what it used to be, and I hope it doesn't have the same effect on you know, MMA, especially if you're a big MMA fan. But we'll see how this plays out. But nonetheless, big story right there of the week. And there's still details coming out. I believe UFC is holding a press conference on Monday to answer more questions and discuss more details about this whole thing. So we'll see how that shakes out. Some Raw thoughts from Monday night, which was billed around John Cena delivering the huge knockout blow to The Rock. He was going to respond to The Rock's most recent retort, that taped promo that The Rock did about 2 weeks ago from his home, which I thought was great. This was going to be John Cena's live response to The Rock, and where he basically kind of put him in his place. And let's just say that John Cena did not exactly put The Rock in his place. Now, perhaps there's some Cena fans listening to this podcast right now that think, oh, Solomon Monster, you're full of shit. Cena mopped the floor with The Rock. The Rock couldn't even show up live and all this and that. And all I can say to that is put the pipe down and quit smoking, because Cena apparently at the end of his promo thought that he did a pretty good job. You know, he delivered another rap. He said he wasn't going to rap, he was going to do hip-hop. It was a rap, because apparently that's all he knows how to do. And I think his rapping skills are great. You know, I've said before, when Cena did that battle rap, well, I guess it wasn't a battle rap, it was more of a freestyle a couple of weeks ago, I thought he did a great job. I still think The Rock kicked his ass. But it was refreshing to see the old-school John Cena back. That was what kind of got Cena over in the first place. When he was a heel on SmackDown, and then later a babyface, he was still doing the rapping until they went PG, and he just, and even before they went PG, because they didn't really go PG until 2008. But, you know, it was before that, Cena just dropped the rapping from his act. And it was a mistake, because obviously John Cena can cut a good promo, and oftentimes he does not. But I thought a couple weeks ago he did a fine job. So he goes back to the well again, and he's doing this rap, and, you know, to me, it was just kind of like, okay, you know, whatever, it's all right. And then he hit the part where he mentioned the pearl necklace, and he pulled out a pearl necklace. Now, I'm not going to get into this here. I know we have some younger listeners who perhaps have absolutely no idea what the hell the meaning was of including a pearl necklace in this promo. I will say this. I don't understand, even almost a week later, what the purpose of that was in the first place. I don't understand what he was trying to do other than just be cute and funny. It would have been one thing if, in the course of the promo, it would have made sense to mention that. But essentially, I'm watching this promo, and Cena just at one point randomly says, pearl necklace, pulls out a pearl necklace, and he's talking as though, you know, he's like giving Rock a pearl necklace. And I feel stupid even talking about this, but to me it's like, why even say that? Like, what does that even mean? You're actually happy to be giving another man a pearl necklace? To me, that just sounds a little disturbing. So that pissed me off, because it was Cena trying to be cute for the sake of being cute, when it actually didn't make any sense in the context of what he was saying. He was just trying to be edgy and, you know, PG-13 for the sake of being PG-13, and it didn't work. It actually made me angry. It was like, this is the best you've got. You're a talented guy. You know, really. You showed that to us a couple of weeks ago with your rap. I know not everybody liked the rap. I loved the rap that Cena did a couple of weeks ago, okay? I gave him credit for it on the show. I give him credit for it again now. And everything he was saying made sense. You know, he was using edgy words, and he mentioned, you know, he pulled out a purple pinwheel and told Rock to blow him. And, you know, again, telling another guy to blow me. Cena is developing a weird pattern of homoerotic behavior here with these comments. But even in the context of that promo, it made sense. You know, The Rock talked trash about him, so he told The Rock to blow me. Okay, fine. I've heard people say that before. But in this case, the whole pearl necklace bullshit, he's pulling, you know, he's smiling. Oh, yeah, I said pearl necklace. Fuck you. I mean, really, it doesn't make sense in the context of the promo, and it just reeks. It just reeks of desperation. So I thought this promo sucked. I thought this was just absolutely fucking atrocious. And at the end of the promo, when Cena smiled at the camera, and he said, 2-0, into the camera, as though he was undefeated in promo battles with The Rock, man, did he look bad. I mean, the crowd didn't even react to his promo in the first place. It wasn't like they gave him a standing ovation. At least when he did the rap a couple of weeks ago, people were into it. They were, you know, they liked what they were hearing. They thought, oh man, like, wow, I can't believe he went there. This time, he didn't get the same reaction at all. Not even close. And this promo was just fucking garbage. And obviously, you don't need me to tell you that, in fact, that it's Rock 2, Cena 0 in this promo battle, which, again, begs the question, what are they looking to accomplish here by this? You know, you've had The Rock embarrass John Cena, your top star, the face of your company now, twice in these little interview battles here. And again, they're not wrestling each other at WrestleMania. They're probably never going to wrestle each other. And, you know, you can say, you know, maybe SummerSlam, maybe WrestleMania in Miami next year. I personally still don't think it's going to happen. But even if it does, what purpose does this serve in making Cena look so, so, so awful? You know, he's your guy. He's your top babyface. He is the face of your organization. He looks like shit in this feud. And then you have The Miz. Now, at least The Miz, at least they booked him to come out at the end of the show. This is the second time now that he's gotten one up on John Cena. He attacked him. He beat him down with the championship belt. They gave him a skull-crushing finale, which it's an awful-looking finisher. I have to say it. At least the way that Miz does it, it looks terrible. He needs a new finisher. And then The Miz got up close and personal in the camera. Talk about an extreme close-up. And he looks weird. Am I the only one who thinks that The Miz looks a little weird? Anyway, so The Miz gets up in the camera and he directs his venom towards The Rock and says, you know, basically, hey, hello, I'm kind of the WWE champion. Don't forget about me. So it was good to see that he tried to get himself back into the mix. But, man, I really don't know where they're going with this. They've got another 2 or 3 weeks left to promote this match at WrestleMania. And as far as Cena versus Miz, I'm just not feeling it. I mean, The Rock has been perfect. He's been pitch perfect in everything he's done so far. And I was of the impression that he would be showing up, and he even said that in his promo a couple of weeks ago. You know, he told Cena, you'll be seeing me, I'll be addressing you sooner than you think. So that still tells me Rock's going to be on Raw one more time before WrestleMania. But then I've read, you know, in two different places that apparently The Rock is not scheduled to appear live on Raw again until the night after WrestleMania. He has officially been announced for Raw the night after Mania. He'll be at Mania, but apparently he's not scheduled to be back on the show at all, at least not in person, in the ring, in the next couple of weeks. So that surprises me a little bit, and I'm not sure I believe that, but that's what's being reported. So if that's the case, they're going to have to do a lot to get my interest in this match back up there, because again, Cena versus Miz. Miz is getting the Chris Jericho treatment from 2001. You know, it's interesting. I just, on this vacation here, I finished, finally, after all these years, I finished Chris Jericho's first book, A Lion's Tale, on the Kindle app on my iPhone. And a great, great book. And I immediately purchased his second book, Undisputed. I have that loaded up on my phone. I'm about 40% through Undisputed already. I'm about 22 chapters in. And I actually just passed the point where he talks about winning the Undisputed Championship in 2001. And if you'll recall, Jericho beat Austin and Rock in the same night, but of course he did so in a fluky way. And his entire initial reign as world champion was just treated as a complete joke. And it built to the Jericho-Triple H match at WrestleMania 18, where Jericho lost the belt, and the build-up to that match where he was essentially, you know, Stephanie McMahon's lackey, and the stuff with, you know, Triple H and Stephanie were going through a divorce, and the dog Lucy that Jericho accidentally ran over with his car, and just all this stupid bullshit. And the point is, this was at a time when the NWO had come in to WWE. Jarrett, you know, Hogan, Hall, and Nash in February of 2002 made their debut. They were the big story. You still had Austin Rock. Triple H's comeback was the other big story. And here you have Chris Jericho, who for 11-plus years worked his way up the ranks to become the undisputed champion, the very first officially recognized undisputed wrestling champion. And he's being treated as like a third or fourth act on the show. I mean, just completely could not be taken seriously. And The Miz, in his title reign so far in many ways, reminds me of Jericho's title reign. I mean, it's almost eerily similar in that Jericho won the Undisputed title in December of 2001, and Miz won the WWE Championship in December of 2010. And so both of these guys have these almost what feels like a placeholder title reign here in the months leading up to WrestleMania. Jericho lost the title. I'm almost positive that Miz is going to lose the belt, although if I were booking, I'll tell you what, if they want to really try to make Miz look strong and go all the way with him, I would have Miz retain at WrestleMania. I mean, obviously, I would keep the Rock-Cena stuff going. I would not have Rock and Cena embrace and become buddy-buddy at the end of WrestleMania. I think that would suck. I would keep the tension building between the two in the event that perhaps The Rock does want to do a match at some point. So perhaps The Rock factors into the outcome of that match and leads to Miz retaining the championship over Cena. You know, many months ago, I actually talked perhaps about doing a double turn, where if you wanted Miz to become a babyface and you finally wanted to turn Cena heel, you can do a Bret Austin-type double turn between the two at Mania. I don't see that happening. But I'm just saying, I would probably, you know, since everybody assumes Miz is dropping the belt, why not have him keep it? I'm not a big fan of swerves all the time, but this is one swerve that might actually work. Now, if you did that, you might not want that match to go on last. And since I think that match should go on last, perhaps not. That's not the outcome that you want. But, you know, you got to do something to help get the Miz over. He's trying, but they're not really giving him a whole lot of assistance right now. And, yeah, again, I just, you know, the parallels between him and Jericho in his first title reign are just eerily similar. And things worked out in the end for Jericho, but again, it took many, many more years for him to be taken seriously as a threat. In fact, it wasn't until he left the company and came back after 2 years and then turned heel that people finally started to take him seriously, and he won the world title, held the world title for many months, had that great feud with Shawn Michaels, and really, I think in the eyes of myself and many people, moved up to you know, being a true main event guy that people could take seriously. The Miz is pretty fucking far from being a main event level guy that people could take seriously, and they're going to have to do a lot, I think, to get him to that point. The Michael Cole-Jerry Lawler feud continues. Of course, Michael Cole was on Raw to announce his special guest referee for WrestleMania. I love the little swerve there throwing JBL out there. I did not see that one coming. It was good to see JBL, even if it was just for a one-time-only appearance in Texas. And, of course, as I talked about last week, the referee did, in fact, turn out to be Stone Cold Steve Austin, which begs the question, again, I know I'm nitpicking here, but if they promoted Austin as being on Raw all week long, and essentially Austin really just came out to crash the party with Cole and JBL, and then he left and we never heard from him again, what was Austin there to do in the first place? Right? I mean, was I the only one wondering that when the segment was over, when the show was over? So anyway, JBL is in the ring, and he's about to sign this open contract to be the referee for the Cole Lawler match at WrestleMania. The glass shatters. Austin comes out. He got a big reaction from the crowd, but nothing close to what The Rock got. And I know, you know, again, The Rock was off TV for 7 years, and Austin's been on TV more often and all that, but you know, again, Austin at one point was the biggest star in wrestling. And he will go down as one of the biggest stars in the history of professional wrestling. And I just wonder if, because it's not as though Austin has been on TV a lot. In fact, it had been a full year since we last saw Austin on television. And he hasn't wrestled since 2003. But I've always wondered if that run in 03 and maybe part of 04 as the Sheriff on Raw. Remember Sheriff Austin? He would come out and he would ride his ATV down to the ring, and he had a little badge, and he was almost, he not quite at the level of a Santino Marella, but Austin was turned into a joke for a while there, for many months, in fact, on Raw, back around 03. And I just wonder if he ever fully recovered from that, because here's a guy that, you know, became a big star because he was this take no prisoners, take no shit, no nonsense kind of guy. You know, he drank beer, he cursed people out. He was a man of the people, and he was not a joke. He was not a comedy character. He was not a chicken shit heel, at least not until he turned heel in 01. And then when they fucked with his character and the whole Sheriff Austin thing and all that, I mean, if I remember correctly, that's when the Steve Austin segments on TV started to do poor in the ratings, because Austin was always a ratings draw. And when people could no longer take him seriously, people just stopped caring and they stopped tuning into his segments. I don't know that he ever fully recovered from that. I mean, maybe I'm just looking, I'm overanalyzing this, but Austin, when he comes out, does not get the kind of reaction that I would expect him to get. And which is not to say that he didn't get a decent pop for himself on Monday night, but I don't know. It wasn't quite what I was expecting. But in any event, he comes out, he gives JBL a stunner. And you know what? Maybe this is part of it. Because, look, I enjoy Steve Austin segments. I thought this segment was pretty damn good. I enjoyed the hell out of it. But still, it's almost, you know, when Austin comes out, he gives the guy a kick to the gut, and he gives him a stunner, and everybody bumps for it. And it's a fun thing. But I don't know that people can really take Austin seriously anymore. You know, and not just because he hasn't wrestled in so many years. I mean, you cannot wrestle for years and years, and like The Rock, people will still take you seriously. You can still cut these very passionate, very intense promos. You know, and that whole what business certainly didn't do Austin. Well, I mean, I guess it was good for Austin, but it didn't do any favors to all the other wrestlers who cut promos over the years. But, you know, Austin comes out, he gives somebody like a little light, like a love tap to the gut, a little stunner, and they bump for it, and it's like, oh, yeah, you know, great. But I don't know. There's just something about Austin that it's hard to take him seriously. Maybe we'll see a different side of him on Tough Enough. But so anyway, lays out JBL, sees the contract laying on the canvas, which JBL never did sign, picks it up and puts his name on the contract. So Steve Austin will be at WrestleMania. He will officiate the match. Michael Cole selling during the segment from start to finish was just fantastic. I mean, even at the beginning when he was in the ring in his white suit, and he's teasing people that Austin's going to be the ref, and then he calls them all fools and brings out JBL, and he's... I mean, Cole was just the complete and polar opposite of Cole as an announcer was Cole as a performer in this segment. He was great. And Austin goes on the outside of the ring. Cole's back at the announce booth. He's asking him, why? Why, Steve? I never did anything to you. And Austin pours beer on his head and says, you know, wishes him luck and pushes him down, and I thought this was great. I mean, I thought, you know, and some people are complaining, you know, should they have done that? You know, Michael Cole, people are waiting for him to get his comeuppance, and here's Austin on Raw pouring beer on him and embarrassing him. I didn't see anything wrong with it. I didn't see a single fucking thing wrong with this entire segment, because it's not like he gave Cole a stone cold stunner, which I'm sure he will at WrestleMania. He didn't give him a stunner, you know. On SmackDown, when Cole came out, Cena picked him up for the FU. He didn't actually deliver it. You can tease things like that, but as long as you don't deliver until the big payoff, which will be at WrestleMania, I don't see anything wrong with that. So I thought Cole was great. Austin was fine in his role. JBL was great. The crowd went crazy for the end of the segment. They went nuts. And I enjoyed this. And Jerry Lawler finally came out. I like that they're keeping the two of them apart. I just wonder, you know, what's going to happen after WrestleMania? How do you reconcile putting the two of them back together like nothing ever happened? I just don't see how you can do that. And if you're not going to do that, then it begs the question, what happens with the announcers after WrestleMania? You know, especially if you're not going to bring back Jim Ross, who I wouldn't be shocked to see JR back at WrestleMania, but I would not expect JR to be back, for example, on Raw every week. So what do? I think Josh Matthews has been doing a fine job. You know, I suppose they could have Josh out there with Lawler and just keep Cole on SmackDown, or maybe do what they used to do during the Nitro days. And you know what? They even did this on Raw for a certain period of time back around 96, 97, where the first hour of the show you have an announce team And then the second hour of the show, it's a different announce team. So, you know, I could see them doing something like that potentially, but I guess we'll wait until after Mania and see what they have up their sleeve. Now, as far as Michael Cole interrupting the Divas, I know this has been a source of contention amongst people this week. You know, even Bret Hart was, I think he made a comment on his Twitter, he was appalled. Because, you know, Bret Hart is actually a big fan of the women. Well, in more ways than one, but in terms of women's wrestling. And he was very disgusted at Michael Cole's interruption during the championship match between Eve and I think it was Nikki Bella. And all I'm going to say is this. I've, in recent weeks, complained about Cole, you know, burying people on commentary and calling Natalya fat. You know, for some reason, that really got under my skin. Because, of course, as I suspected, looking back on it now, weeks later, it was not, in fact, part of any sort of storyline. He just was calling her fat. I'm sure Vince McMahon fed him those lines. And it really didn't serve any purpose other than to insult and demean Natalya. And I think that's a shitty thing to do. In this case, it was a really shitty thing, don't get me wrong. I mean, these women are in there. They're not having a great match, but they're working their ass off. It is a women's championship match. It's not like it was just some sort of insignificant match. The title was on the line. And Eve, you know, for what it's worth, Eve has turned into a pretty good wrestler. You know, clearly, again, when she's in there, she's trying to get better. You know, she's got that flying armbar submission hold of hers and all that. And for Cole to interrupt the match in the manner that he did, and it felt very real there when he and Josh Matthews were going back and forth. It was like, and again, I'm sure it was all part of the shtick, but it was almost like Josh was genuinely annoyed. And he basically just kept trying to get Cole to stop, and Cole wouldn't stop. And then the match was over, and Cole was like, oh, thank God this is over. Now, I will say the match was not anything great. It wasn't like they were having a three-star affair in there. But still, it was a pretty shitty thing for him to do. I'm not going to get angry about it because I just don't care about the women's matches. They put so little effort into making me care and making them mean anything at all, even when the title is on the line, that, you know what? Michael Cole is not even completely wrong. Like, there were few, if any, people in that audience who gave a shit about that women's match. And it's not the women's fault. It's Vince McMahon's fault. It's the company's fault. They don't do a good enough job making people care about these matches. So I can't get all that upset about it because, you know what? It's a match. It really didn't matter. The fact that he interrupted that match, it was disrespectful? Absolutely. But did anybody really care? I don't really think so. Sheamus, officially on a losing streak, he acknowledged as much in his little promo after he lost via countout to Daniel Bryan on Monday night. Apparently, it's worth a couple of ratings notes here on Raw. Raw's rating, I think, was back up to around a 3.9 this week. Raw's ratings the last two or three weeks have been phenomenal by Raw standards. And again, you could thank The Rock for that. It was interesting to note that the Austin segment apparently was like the biggest segment on the show by a wide margin, which is not all that surprising, especially when it's Austin's first appearance on TV in a year, and the Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler stuff has actually been doing pretty good for itself on TV. Michael Cole has turned into a bit of a ratings draw, but except when he's on commentary, he's more like ratings poison. But the Daniel Bryan Sheamus segment, apparently, in looking at the breakdown of the quarter-hour numbers, which, you know, I try not to pay too much attention to the, I don't live and die by the ratings every week like WWE and TNA do. But you can't ignore the fact that the Daniel Bryan Sheamus match, that whole segment from Monday night, actually lost over 1 million viewers, which is, I cannot remember a segment on Raw losing that many viewers in one particular segment. I mean, even a lot of the Divas matches that people just tune away in droves, I mean, they could lose anywhere from 300,000 to 600,000 viewers in a given segment for a women's match that nobody cares about. But you double that number, and that's how many people turn Raw off during the Daniel Bryan Sheamus thing. And I'm not willing to lay that at the feet of either Daniel Bryan or Sheamus. I could lay that at the feet of how they've been booked. But my God, 1.1 million people turned that show off during that segment. That is not good. Not good for Sheamus either, who's been treated like a joke. He has basically decided to put his career on the line next week against Sheamus, and it just against Daniel Bryan, rather, in a rematch for the United States Championship. Now, as far as I know, the two of them are supposed to work together in a match at WrestleMania, so it's possible that Sheamus wins the title next week and defends it against Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania. Or they could just have Sheamus lose, as he's been losing every week, and Sheamus is, quote, fired from Raw. I find it interesting that they're going to do this angle at a time when they've done this about two or three times in the last couple of weeks. They did it with Vicky Guerrero on SmackDown and Dolph Ziggler, both of whom were fired and both of whom were back on Raw this past Monday night. They did it with Kelly Kelly, who was fired, and Kelly Kelly is already back on SmackDown. They did it with John Cena a couple of months ago, and we all know how that turned out. Cena never left. He never missed one TV show, Cena did. So, basically what they've done, they've taken this stipulation of people being fired or losing their career in a match, and they've completely turned it into something that absolutely nobody could possibly believe in. So, Sheamus can put his career on the line if he wants to next week, but it ain't going to mean shit because nobody in their right mind could possibly believe that Sheamus is actually going to quit the company. So I don't even know why they do this. I really don't even know why they bother doing this anymore. I mentioned Dolph Ziggler. He is officially a member of the Raw roster. Vicky Guerrero could be a member of the Raw roster, provided that she can get past Trish Stratus in a match on Raw next week. My expectation is that Vicky is going to win. Trish is going to lose after being cost the match, perhaps by Lay Cool, to set up some sort of tag match at Mania that Trish is scheduled to be a part of. Last I read, it was going to be Trish teaming up with John Morrison and perhaps one or two other divas against possibly Lay Cool and maybe Dolph Ziggler and maybe Vicky. Some sort of combination of those people. And Morrison and Ziggler, neither of them have a match at this point, and they actually had a singles match against each other that Ziggler won clean. So perhaps they are setting something up for WrestleMania. So, yeah, next week we get the Trish-Vicky match. Snooki from the Jersey Shore is the guest star on Raw, which just, again, makes TNA look so second-rate. TNA insists on bringing in these Jersey Shore people. And while I do agree that Jay Wow is far more attractive than Snooki, Snooki is the big star of the Jersey Shore. And the fact that TNA has gone out, they've gotten, well, what's her name, Angelina or whatever her name is from the Jersey Shore. They got Jay Wow, and WWE turns around and they get Snooki. They get the only person from the Jersey Shore that people actually care about. And, yeah, that just shows the difference between the two companies right there. Now, speaking of segments on Raw that did well or not well, I mentioned Daniel Bryan and Sheamus chased away over 1 million people. Interesting to note that the Hall of Fame video package they put together for Sonny is going into the Hall of Fame this year, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. That segment picked up several hundred thousand viewers. I think it was between 400,000 and 500,000 people tuned into the show during that particular segment. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means Sonny is a draw. I think she was kind of joking about that on her Twitter or her Facebook, that after, you know, 14 years out of the spotlight, she's still a ratings draw. I don't know about that, but I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, again, all the WWE diva segments routinely lose hundreds of thousands of viewers. And this one little segment with Sonny and her video package, here's, you know, the original diva who, I mean, hasn't even really been with WWE in well over a decade. And they show videos of her back during her more attractive days, her younger days, and they pick up all these viewers is quite telling. I don't know what it tells, but it's a telling statement nonetheless. So that's Raw in a nutshell from Monday night. Undertaker did a promo as well. It was boring. I don't know what else to really say about it. This Triple H Undertaker stuff, they better kick that into high gear here because you know, their promo work has been good, but they haven't really been doing anything to get me overly interested in this match. So if they're going to get Shawn Michaels involved somehow, they better do it fast, because my interest in many of the matches on this show is waning at a very rapid rate. In fact, I'll say the one match I'm really looking forward to at this point more than any other is Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole, and right behind that would be Edge and Alberto Del Rio, which I think they've done a fantastic job of promoting this match so far. May as well move on to SmackDown thoughts here. More stuff between Edge and Del Rio this past Friday night. They have strapped that rocket to Del Rio, and they are shooting him into the hemisphere. And they're doing a phenomenal job with him. Now he has his former NXT rookie Brodus Clay with him. Hopefully not a permanent part of his act. I think that role should be reserved for Ricardo Rodriguez. But what we got on Friday night was a special treat. We got the reunion of Edge and Christian, the first time they've teamed up in almost a decade, against Alberto Del Rio and Brodus Clay in the main event. Edge and Christian, in fact, were victorious in the match. And, again, I don't know exactly where they're going with this. I was hoping that it would be a triple threat match at Mania with Edge, Christian, and Del Rio. But you know what? They've done such a good job of promoting this as a singles match, and I have every expectation that Del Rio is going to go over and win the title, that I'd almost rather them keep it a singles match at this point. If Del Rio wins the championship at Mania, I'm sure Edge will get his rematch. But once Del Rio finishes up his stuff with Edge, they can build Christian, perhaps, as a strong number one contender and get a pay-per-view match or two out of it between the two of them. I know Vince McMahon would never, ever put the title on Christian, but I still think it would make for a good pay-per-view feud one-on-one between the two of them. And again, you have the built-in story of Del Rio injuring Christian, tearing his pec all those months ago, putting him out of action. So I thought the tag match at the end of SmackDown was very enjoyable on Friday night. Perhaps, you know, I've seen some people who listen to the show have written in and suggested that perhaps they're setting up for a Christian heel turn on Edge, which we've seen before. It's actually been about a decade since the last time we saw that. And not that I wouldn't be in favor of an Edge-Christian feud. I don't see them going in that direction. And Christian, while he's a fantastic heel, and he's great in that role, he's also great as a babyface, and I think they need more babyfaces than heels on the SmackDown brand right now. So we'll see what involvement Christian has at Mania in this match if they fit him into another match. But I thought the stuff with all four of these guys on SmackDown was great. Michael Cole was promising the interview of the year. He brought John Cena over to SmackDown, and I will say this much. I talked about Cena's promo or his rap from Monday night and how goddamn terrible it was. And it was awful. I just cannot see how anybody listening to this podcast right now could possibly think that what we saw with him on Monday night was good. I just defy anybody who thinks it was good to write in and give me a good logical explanation why. But in contrast to that, I will say that Cena's promo work on Friday night was much better. He was a little goofy at the very beginning, but he actually seemed more serious. He was very annoyed by Michael Cole's antics. You know, Cena said his piece, he went to leave, and Cole said, you know, this interview is not over. I've got more questions for you, or you're afraid of The Miz and all this other stuff. And the way Cena reacted, he didn't react as though it was a comedy segment. This is what we need to see more of from him. He needs to take things a little bit more seriously, especially when in storyline, this is the second time now he's been embarrassed by The Miz, who is the champion that he's facing at WrestleMania. You would think he would take that a little more seriously, the fact that he's been left laying at the end of these TV shows. So he goes to give Michael Cole an attitude adjustment. Jack Swagger is there to save Cole, and of course, Swagger ends up eating an attitude adjustment and looking like a complete jobber. I didn't agree with that at all. I know Swagger has been treated like a joke for a long time, and I know he doesn't actually have a match at Mania. Cena does. He's in the main event. But do you really have to have Swagger just look like a complete fool every week? I mean, you would think they would want some people to take him and his ankle lock seriously. If, you know, here's Swagger threatening on Monday night to break Steve Austin's ankle at WrestleMania, does anybody in this entire world believe that that's actually going to happen? And what I mean by that is, does anybody believe that Swagger is actually going to beat down Steve Austin at WrestleMania? And in large part, that's because people just can't take Swagger seriously, and they certainly didn't do him any favors on Friday night. But again, I thought overall the Michael Cole segment, of all the segments on the show, was if not the best, it was one of the strongest ones. I liked the Rey Mysterio-Drew McIntyre match from Friday night as well. I just thought Drew showed an aggressive side that we really should see more of out of him. And we kind of saw that a little bit at the Elimination Chamber as well. He wasn't in the Chamber match for that long, but I remember when Drew came in, he was a house of fire. I mean, he was going nuts. The people were even, you know, not that they were cheering for him, but they were reacting to him. And that's what you want. You want the people to react to you in some form or fashion. So I thought this match with Mysterio on Friday night was a really good showing for him. I just enjoyed it. It was a fun little match. Mysterio wins. They're continuing to build the Mysterio-Cody Rhodes match, which, total undercard match at WrestleMania, I agree. But I'm digging it so far. You know, I mean, Cody has not wrestled in many months. He wears the face mask, you know, pretending that he has been disfigured, even though he looks exactly the same as he's always looked. I don't know if Dusty Rhodes will be in his corner at Mania. You know, Dusty was part of that angle a week or two ago when they both turned on Rey. So I don't know if Dusty will be a Mania or not. But you know what? I think that this is going to be a real make-or-break showing for Cody Rhodes at WrestleMania. You know, here's a guy who, I mean, for the most part, people thought that Ted DiBiase was going to be the guy coming out of Legacy that would become a big star. And I don't know whose cornflakes he pissed in, but DiBiase has just, I mean, he has fallen to the depths of hell on that Raw roster to the point where I wonder, you know, if WWE is planning from, and they are from what I understand, cutting a whole bunch of people after WrestleMania, would they actually cut DiBiase? You know, here's a guy that they did invest a lot in. They had high hopes for him, and maybe they still do. You know, they even put him in one of their movies. You know, he was in the Marine too. He's got the pedigree. You know, the Million Dollar Man is his father. I don't know that they would fire him, but you know what? I don't think he's immune to it either. And if they're looking to get rid of people, if their doctrine is we're going to cut people from the roster after WrestleMania who are not making money for us, and they're not selling merchandise, and they're not moving tickets, they're not a drawing card in some way, DiBiase fits the bill to a T. He has been completely buried 6 feet under. And meanwhile, Cody Rhodes is the one who has a real opportunity to break out on the SmackDown brand. You know, he was handpicked by Rey Mysterio. This is a match that Mysterio went to the office and said, I want to face Cody Rhodes at WrestleMania. He likes Cody. He sees something in him, and he figured this is a way to get Cody on WrestleMania in a meaningful match. And I give Rey Mysterio a lot of credit for doing that because, you know, Mysterio could have kept his mouth shut. They probably would have put him in a big match at Mania against somebody else. And in the meantime, a lot of people are complaining, oh, Mysterio and Cody Rhodes, what a jobber match, who cares? I look at it a little bit differently. I don't see it as a jobber match at all. I see it as a match that even if Mysterio wins, if Cody goes in there and has a real breakout, real great performance, it could mean big things for him in the future. And he's got something there. You know, he's got charisma. He's good on the mic. He's a good worker. He's small. And I personally don't care about that, but we all know how Vince McMahon tends to feel about smaller guys. You know, Evan Bourne got a great push for a couple of weeks, and then, you know, it went nowhere. Daniel Bryan seemed to be getting a pretty good push, and he's really gone nowhere either. So there's a pattern here, but that could be a sleeper match at WrestleMania. That's a match I would look out for. Mysterio and Cody Rhodes, that has the potential to be maybe not a show stealer necessarily, but a pretty damn good match, and I'm actually looking forward to it. A couple of other notes here. I forgot to mention this before, that after Raw Monday night, coming off Cena's fantastically awful promo, The Rock responded on Twitter, and he said, quote, wow, can the People's Champ and the Millions recover from that devastating Dr. Seuss final KO blow? Cena equals hot shaved Barney anus garbage. Now, you know, I criticize Cena for the whole pearl necklace thing because it was just being edgy for the sake of being edgy, and it had no place in that promo. And you can say, you know, you can say the same thing about some of what The Rock says, that it's juvenile and all this, but I don't know. The difference is that when The Rock makes a comment like this, and this was just one little Twitter remark, it's not like Rock said this in an actual promo on TV, I still laugh my ass off. Rock has just been fantastic with this stuff, and you gotta know that even if the two of them are totally cool with each other, and they are, that again, the comments that Cena made, even if he was speaking as a puppet on behalf of Vince McMahon, you know, when Cena made all those comments and those interviews all those years ago, that they really did bother The Rock. Even if he's over it, you got to imagine that after Monday night, Rock's got to be feeling like $1 million. Just seeing Cena stammer and stuff and suffer through these promos, that clearly have just they've left a lot to be desired. And I think Rock has proved his point in terms of shutting up Cena. I just think it's fantastic. You know, you try not to pick sides here, and Cena's a good guy and all that, but you know, when you go out there, and whether you're in character or not, and you talk about how your shit doesn't stink, and you think you're so great, and it turns out that you're actually not as great as you thought you were, it's got to make Rock feel real good about himself. The new season of NXT also started on Tuesday night, and your hosts are Matt Stryker and Maurice. So there's one incentive to watch what is essentially a lame duck season of NXT. In that WWE did not want to kill the concept. They wanted to continue with it, but they knew that they're doing Tough Enough, and Tough Enough is going to take a lot away from NXT, and so they've decided to put the bare minimum effort into the new season of Tough Enough. Apparently, they had already filmed some vignettes with some new guys down in Florida that they were going to debut this season, and then the decision was made to go in a different direction at the last minute. So they're doing this thing called NXT Redemption, which essentially is just a rehash where they've brought back a bunch of guys from the past seasons of NXT that were eliminated, and they're giving them a second chance. But get this. Guess what the winner of NXT Season 5 gets? Now, they don't get a championship match. You know, in the past, the winner has been entitled to a singles championship match at the title of their choice, or a tag title match with their pro. Not the case this year. The winner of NXT Season 5, if you can believe this, earns a spot on NXT Season 6. That right there tells you all you need to know about how important they're looking at NXT Season 5. They brought in William Regal as an announcer with Todd Grisham. And Regal is great, but he's very hard to understand sometimes, in that he's very, very reserved. He's a very low talker. So I think that's just something that would come with experience. I'm sure Regal will get better over time. And you can use a show like NXT like this as an experiment for a new announcer. So I don't have any problem with that at all. They've brought back Titus O'Neil. His pro is Hornswoggle. Sure, why not? Jacob Novak. His pro is JTG. Byron Saxton, who... I look at a guy like Byron Saxton, this guy is going to be a star. And I just hope... You know, even if he doesn't win at NXT, I hope that they see they have something in this guy. Because Byron Saxton, from what I've seen, he's a great athlete. He's got a great personality, great charisma, great on the microphone. He's just great. And I don't know why he's mired in this NXT horse shit. You know, this is the kind of guy that, like Sin Cara, they should be giving him his own promo packages and just debuting him on Raw or SmackDown. He should not be floundering on NXT. He has Yoshitatsu as his pro. Lucky Cannon has a little bit of a different look. He's got Tyson Kidd as his pro. Connor O'Brien has Vladimir Kozlov as his pro. So I feel sorry for Mr. O'Brien. And Darren Young, the Black Cena, he's back. He's got Chavo Guerrero as his pro. So, yeah, there you go. A season that absolutely nobody will care about unless you want to see Maurice's legs every week, which not the worst thing in the world to tune into NXT for. But, and you know what? I don't have a problem with them doing this show because it does no harm. You know, it's not taking TV time away from any of the primary shows. They tape it. They air it on the website. It doesn't hurt anybody, so why not? It's just not a season that anybody's going to care about. Quick note here about Impact. I did not have a chance to see Impact this week. Again, I was stranded at an airport down in Florida, and I have not been able to get on YouTube yet or anything and watch any of Impact. I did hear that the Bully Ray Devon stuff, as usual, was great. That seems to be one of the few saving graces of TNA in recent weeks. Their feud has been really good stuff. But from what I understand, this was the second show they taped, I think, from Fayetteville. So I think Impact from this past week, if I'm not mistaken, was once again filmed on location outside of the Impact Zone, because I've heard people raving all week long about the last show, and even after this week's show, how different the show feels being outside of Orlando. Having more people, being in an actual arena, and having that different stage set up. Some people have compared it to Nitro. There's something to be said that even if you take a show like Impact, which can make you just rip the hair right out of your roots most of the time. And you'll have good stuff, you'll have a lot of bad stuff, but there's something to be said for freshening things up and having the show in front of a different crowd with a different type of stage and a different type of arena setup. It just makes it look more more major leagues, basically. And I've heard a lot of people say nothing but good things about that. And the fact that TNA, more so because of budgetary considerations, has no plans on the table at this point, at least for many, many more months, to take Impact on the road, I think that's a big, big mistake. I know it's not a cheap thing to do, but if you have to cut costs in other areas in order to accommodate road tapings, I would do it. Because a lot of people, which again is not to say that, oh, Impact has turned the corner and the ratings are up because they're on the road, by no means, but it just helps in making the show feel special. And I think they need more of that. TNA can use all the help they can get. I personally, without having seen the most recent show, I'm a big fan of that sort of thing. I'm sure if I do go back and watch Impact, that probably will be one of the things I point to that I actually like about the show. And I want them to do more of that. I don't want them to wait 6 or 8 more months before they take the show on location. They need to do that, maybe not every week, even once a month. They need to do more of that. And yeah, I heard a lot of people complimenting Impact because of that. Not that it was a great show from top to bottom, so they still have a lot of mountains to climb, but that was one of the things people seem to really love about the show on Thursday night. All right, so a few quick notes here about two things, and then we'll get to some of your questions. First of all, I mentioned before, I finally finished the first Chris Jericho book, A Lion's Tale. And if you have never read the book before, or perhaps if you have and it's been a long time since the book came out several years ago, it's worth it to go and read it or read it again. It's a really, really good book. It's probably, if not the best, probably the second best pro wrestler book I've read, behind Mick Foley's first book. And in some ways it might even be better. And it's certainly, it's a funny book. I mean, Jericho's a really humorous guy. And I enjoyed a lot of the stories about him coming up in the business, working in Canada, working in Mexico, working in Japan, working in Germany. The stories with him and Lance Storm and, you know, just all that stuff. And you know, learning about his mom and the accident that she was in that you know, made her a paraplegic. You know, you take the funny stuff with the more serious stuff. And his experiences working with some of the great veterans of the industry, Mil Máscaras, who, of course, is the uncle, I believe, of Alberto Del Rio, somebody who Jericho does not personally care much for. I don't know too many people, too many wrestlers that have done interviews and such that think very highly of Mil Máscaras. But in any event, really, really, really good stuff. And I found myself at the very end of the book, because the book ends off literally at the moment that Jericho was about to step through the curtain for his WWF debut in 1999. So I didn't know how much I was going to like that book, because I was really interested in hearing about his experiences in coming to the WWF. And you didn't really get a lot of that. It was all about his pre-WWF stuff and his WCW days and negotiating with Eric Bischoff, his first deal in the company, and how he was treated behind the scenes and how people really were backstage, like Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash and Scott Hall and Lex Luger and stuff like that. Really, really, really fascinating stuff. So check it out if you have not already done so. I've started on his second book. Like I said, I'm about 22 chapters into it, which is less than half, but I'm still about 40% into it already. So I'm making progress. I'm enjoying what I'm reading so far. A lot of talk about the backstage politics and stuff in WWF and stuff that he had to contend with at first, working with China, which he was not a big fan of doing. Early, you know, political clashes with Triple H. Actually, I'll give one little story away here. One of the things that I kind of laughed at and wasn't all that surprised by. You know, Jericho had a lot of enemies backstage in WWE when he first came in. And a lot of people who thought he didn't know how to work. And a lot of veterans, a lot of main event guys, including Undertaker and people like that, who he raves about. But at first, when Jericho, that first month or two when he came in, Jericho didn't wrestle a match. All he did was come out and insult people in promos. And nobody really gave him any guidance. Vince McMahon, who promised to always tell him, you know, I'll always let you know what I want you to do and how I want you to do it, really didn't give any guidance to Jericho at first. So he would just go out there and you know, as this heel, cut these promos on guys like Steve Austin and The Rock and The Undertaker and Ken Shamrock, just completely berating them and making them look second rate. You know, Undertaker would come out on one episode of Raw and do this promo. It was at the time that he was teaming up with The Big Show as the Unholy Alliance, and Undertaker came out on the show and cut this long promo that wasn't particularly exciting about, I don't know, some weird story about being in the desert and all this other stuff. That a promo that I vaguely remember watching. And Jericho came out, I guess, either the next segment or the next week and said that The Undertaker's promo was boring and all this other stuff. And I remember Jericho mentioned Steve Austin came up to him backstage and you know, basically told him, listen, if you're gonna say this stuff about these guys, you know, you better be careful because people are getting genuinely upset with you. They think you're, you know, you got this big head, you came from WCW, you think you know how to work, and you think you know how everything is, and you really don't know shit. And anyway, Jericho had massive heat, and he went to Triple H to ask him, do I have heat? And Triple H was very honest with him and said, yeah, you got heat. You have nuclear heat right now. And Triple H was very honest with him as far as, you know, why people were upset with him and what he had to do to try to change that. But he tells this story about, you know, his relationship with Triple H and trying to find the arena one day, getting to a show. And he thought Triple H was a friend of his. You know, Triple H had come up to him early on and said, listen, if there's anything you need, if you ever have any questions or need any help, let me know. And Triple H gave him his cell phone number. And Jericho tells of the time that he was trying to find the arena, and for whatever reason he was lost and he couldn't find it. So he decided to call Triple H to see if he could help him. And he called Triple H, who I guess was already at the building, probably hanging out with his DX buddies. And I'm paraphrasing here. It was something to the effect of, Jericho asked him, can you tell me how to get to the arena? And Triple H's answer was, sure, get a map. And he hung up on him. You know, Jericho could hear people laughing in the background, and then Triple H hung up on him. So, you know, not surprising for me to hear a story like that, but still, entertaining as all hell. I mean, he doesn't pull any punches. He talks about The Rock and working with The Rock. The Rock was one of his few friends that really tried to help him out at the beginning, because Rock went through a lot of the same stuff that Jericho went through at first. You know, Rock came in with this big push out of the gate that he perhaps wasn't ready for. People resented him for it. The fans resented him for it. And things worked out pretty well for The Rock. And I'd say they worked out pretty well for Jericho, too. But, yeah, so far, some really entertaining stories. I'm not even halfway done with the book. So I would already give it a recommendation, a thumbs up so far, for Undisputed, which just went on sale a couple of weeks ago and is already number 9. On the New York Times bestseller list, which makes it the first pro wrestler autobiography, I guess, pro wrestler book of its kind, to reach that high on the New York Times bestseller charts without being promoted by or being a WWE book. You know, WWE did promote Jericho's book one time on TV. They mentioned it briefly on Raw a couple of weeks ago, but you haven't seen commercials for it. You know, Jericho, it's been this grassroots effort on his part to promote his own book. He's been doing all these book signings, and number 9 on the bestseller charts. That's pretty damn good. So check it out if you have not already started reading it. It's so far so good. It sounds like a really fun book. The other thing I wanted to mention here was, in the spirit of WrestleMania season, WWE Classics on Demand has WrestleMania 4 currently airing in the rotation. And WrestleMania 4, it's divided into two parts. One of the longest WrestleManias of all time, or at least up until recent years, where WrestleMania more routinely is 4 hours in length. This was a 4 hour long WrestleMania show, because this was the Mania that featured the 16-man single elimination tournament for the vacant WWF Championship. You may recall Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, had a match on live on NBC in a show called The Main Event. And to this day, I think it is one of the, if not the most watched pro wrestling match in the history of American television. I think it had something like 33 million viewers or something ridiculous like that. And it was the match where Hogan got screwed out of the championship by the evil Hebner referee. Dave Hebner was the Hebner that was officiating many WWF matches at the time. His brother Earl was officiating for a different wrestling promotion. Vince signed him. And so it was actually Earl who was refereeing this match, but a lot of people didn't know the difference. So Andre throws Hogan down, covers him. Hogan clearly gets his shoulder up before the count of two, let alone, or at the count of two. And Hebner keeps counting, counts three, and awards Andre the championship. Andre tried to give the title to Ted DiBiase, and obviously by the letter of the law in the WWE rulebook, President Jack Tunney decreed you are not allowed to do that. And he declared the championship was vacant, that DiBiase is not recognized as ever being champion. And so the title was on the line in a tournament. Hogan and Andre automatically got a bye into the second round, and they each proceeded to eliminate each other. It was a double disqualification, so neither man advanced in the tournament. And it was the Macho Man, Randy Savage, who wrestled four times in one night. He beat the Natural Butch Reed, Greg the Hammer Valentine, One Man Gang, and the Million Dollar Man in the main event to become the WWF champion. And, you know, it was a great storyline for Savage. It was a great way to get him over. I love that him and Elizabeth came out four different times in four different colored outfits. They tried to match each time in terms of the colors they were wearing. And, yeah, there were some good matches in the tournament, but for the most part, WrestleMania 4 does not hold up. It was not one of my favorite WrestleManias to begin with. It was, you know, I remember watching the show and, you know, Trump Plaza. There's Donald Trump, a very young-looking Donald Trump in the front row. They had some other celebrities, Vanna White from Wheel of Fortune, Mr. Baseball Bob Uecker, who, of course, went into the WWE Hall of Fame last year, I believe it was, as a celebrity inductee. And Uecker was hilarious on this show. Jesse the Body was great on commentary, as always, with Gorilla Monsoon. Bobby Heenan was entertaining as all hell, wearing his padded dog suit. He was in a six-man tag with the Islanders against the British Bulldogs and Coco Beware. And this was after the storyline where Heenan and the Islanders had kidnapped Matilda, which was the Bulldogs' actual bulldog. And so in this match, the dog was back at ringside, and Bobby wore this dog suit. He wore it for the whole match, and he actually got the winning fall, too. Bobby Heenan won the match, and then they sicked Matilda on him after the match. But it was kind of funny because, you know, the Bulldogs were known for not being the nicest guys in the world, especially Dynamite Kid, and just watching the way they treated this poor dog was actually getting on my nerves because they had the dog on a leash at ringside, and when the match was over and they were chasing after Heenan, I mean, I think it was Davey Boy. He grabbed the leash, or he grabbed the dog, and just yanked the dog off the little platform that he was standing on. And the dog was... I felt so sorry for this dog, because this dog, first of all, looked like he was petrified to be out there in front of all these people. And then when they get Heenan trips in the aisleway. And so they take the dog, and it looks like they're trying to sick the dog on him, like the dog's going to bite him and tear him to shreds. And clearly, this was a non-aggressive bulldog on this particular night, because this dog did not want to have anything to do with biting Bobby Heenan or anybody else, for that matter. And they're just throwing the dog on top of him and just tossing him around. And it's like, my God, what a bunch of assholes. And you know what they say, what goes around comes around. But in any event, Honky Tonk Man and Brutus Beefcake for the Intercontinental title, it sucked. It really wasn't much of anything. Demolition won their first tag team titles from Strikeforce in a, you know, pretty good tag match. They had the Battle Royal at the beginning of the show, which, of course, featured the angle that turned Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation babyface. It was when Bad News Brown and Bret Hart both worked together to eliminate the Junkyard Dog. They were united as one, and then Bad News Brown attacked Bret from behind because, after all, it is every man for himself. Threw Bret Hart out of the ring and was celebrating with his trophy. Bret Hart, of course, being the sore loser crybaby that he is, comes back in, beats up Bad News Brown, destroys the trophy. And I was watching this, and the only thing I could think of when I was watching Bret Hart throw this little hissy fit and destroy the trophy was it reminded me of Montreal after the match when he was destroying all the equipment around ringside at the announce table. So very eerie to watch this. And this was in 1988. This was almost a full decade before Montreal ever happened. Just a very long show. Not really any good matches at all. I mean, it was kind of disappointing because the way the tournament was set up, Ricky Steamboat was in the opening round, and he had a match with Greg Valentine. And it was actually kind of funny because Steamboat, for whatever reason, brought his son, who they kept calling the Little Dragon, down to the ringside area with him. And I don't know why, but he carried his baby boy down to the ring. Of course, this is Richie Steamboat, who is now, he's in developmental. He perhaps is going to be the next big breakout, you know, second generation WWE star. And here he is as a baby, the biggest cheeks you've ever seen in the world. And I remember thinking as I'm watching this kid, God, he's got fat cheeks. And then Jesse Ventura, without skipping a beat, turns around and says, my God, look at this kid's cheeks. He's got cheeks like Bundy. Referring, of course, to King Kong Bundy. So Steamboat fought Valentine in, you know, a pretty long match, and then he lost. And the thing is, if Steamboat would have won this match, we would have had Steamboat versus Savage in the second round, which would have been a rematch from WrestleMania the previous year, and you could have put Savage over Steamboat this time. And the only thing I could guess is that they didn't want, I guess they just didn't want to run the risk of Savage getting booed. But you could have avoided that easily by, you know, having the match, and then after the match, you have Steamboat kind of shake hands with Savage and raise his hand and give him the seal of approval. You know, you weren't going to get the kind of match you got at WrestleMania the previous year. The thing about all these tournament matches was that they were all rushed because you have so many matches that you have to get through that no match in this tournament is going to get any real great length of time. So perhaps they said, you know what, they had such a great match at WrestleMania 3, there's no way we can give them enough time to let them put on as good of a match, so why even do it? I mean, I guess I can understand that, but to me, that was the biggest disappointment of the entire tournament. Was not, and clearly people were looking forward to seeing Steamboat and Savage, because when Steamboat lost to Valentine, they were very upset, and even shocked almost at the outcome of that match. And to me, that was the biggest disappointment of the tournament. Just, you know, overall, a very lackluster WrestleMania, a lot of matches that they just had to rush through that didn't really mean much of anything, a lot of disqualifications and countouts and just bullshit finishes. I would hesitate to give WrestleMania 4 a thumbs up. So that's my little impromptu WrestleMania 4 review for everybody listening. All right, so let's get to your letters here, and we got a whole bunch of them, but the first one I wanted to just read here comes from Bill, one of our longtime listeners, who wrote in about a week or so ago. This is in reference to a question. Somebody, I think it was in the last mailbag, had mentioned regarding whether or not Sting could technically be considered a WWE employee at the time that he wrestled Ric Flair on that last Nitro from Panama City Beach in March of 01. And, you know, my argument was no. You know, nice try, but no. But Bill actually has some interesting thoughts on this. He can shed some more light on this because he is an ex-employee of AOL, which at the time was part of the Time Warner regime. And he knows how this particular situation played out. So I thought it would be prudent for me to mention this here to kind of put this issue to bed once and for all. He notes that it was interesting. WWE didn't even own WCW at the time that final Nitro aired. I mean, all that was in place was something called an intention to acquire agreement. So basically, Time Warner named a price, Vince McMahon agreed to that price, and more or less signed a letter of intent to acquire the WCW brand. So in storyline, it was believed that WWE finalized the deal, and they were now the new owners at the time that final Nitro aired, and apparently that was not the case. At that point, Turner was still technically the owner of the WCW organization. They, being Time Warner and WWE, did finalize the deal later that same week to ensure that the storyline would be true to form and consistent for the following week. However, everyone who was on the final Nitro show were technically WCW independent contractors, which was legally and technically viewed as a separate company and not legally affiliated with WWE. Now, as far as all those big names that, in many cases, sat out their deal, and eventually, all but Sting did come to WWE. But as far as guys like Hogan, Hall, Nash, Goldberg, Eric Bischoff, well, maybe not Bischoff, but Scott Steiner, all of them were signed to Turner contracts that were not absorbed by WWE. And, you know, AOL Time Warner was more or less forced to eat the financial debts that was reported to be up in the $60 million range, about $10 million per talent. So that was the reason why the NWO and Goldberg and Steiner were not immediately brought back to WWE television. They were not stupid. If they knew they could sit out and collect some big fat paychecks, then that's what they were going to do. So anyway, Bill sheds some more light on this, which I am very much appreciative to him for. Some very interesting insights here. He also mentions here that, you know, the reason he knows about this deal was because AOL. It was AOL who wanted to dump WCW. They didn't want to be associated with it, and really, who can blame them? Time Warner was supposed to have dropped WCW prior to the agreed merger in 2000, but Time Warner couldn't find anybody to buy the company right away. And AOL gave them a little breathing room and just told Time Warner to get it done. So, and you know, the story about Eric Bischoff putting together that group of investors, which, you know, in the end, the investors backed out when they found out that WCW's TV slots were no longer going to be available to them. And we all know the rest of the story. Vince McMahon swoops in, buys WCW, and the rest is history. So, again, thanks to Bill for shedding some more light on that whole situation here. 10 years to the month that all of this went down. It's been a decade, if you can believe it. Brent writes in, and he's not the only one who was written in to ask me about this. I made a comment on episode 149 about someone backstage who was very vocal and was speaking up about Triple H when he buried, when he was essentially burying the entire roster during his first promo back on that Raw show. And the only thing I could say about that, and I don't know with 100% certainty, I heard the name CM Punk. Now, I can't confirm that, but that was the name that I heard from more than one place. So, you know, we'll just kind of leave it at that right now. Brian writes in, just got done watching the 10th anniversary DVD of SmackDown, and one of the greatest moments on the DVD was TLC 3 from May of 01 with the Dudleys, the Hardys, Edge and Christian, and Jericho and Chris Benoit, who were actually the defending champions at the time. This match, by the way, was taped on SmackDown the night after Jericho and Benoit had that great match against Austin and Triple H, which is a match that Jericho talks about in his new book. So anyway, apparently on the SmackDown DVD, they actually showed Benoit on camera, and they showed him getting the belts on top of the ladder and winning the match. Now, I was under the impression that Benoit was banished from all WWE programming because of what happened. If that's the case, then why did they show him on the DVD? I'm glad they did, but it just surprised me. Well, it surprised me, too. This is the first I'm hearing of this. I don't have the DVD. I have not watched the DVD. I mean, I can understand why they would want to put the match on there, because it is truly one of the greatest matches in SmackDown history. That TLC 3 is often a forgotten match, more so now in light of what's happened with Benoit. If the match is on the DVD, and this is a relatively new DVD that they've released in the last couple of years, I'm assuming this was released after the events of 2007. If they show that match on there and they show Benoit winning the match, which they would have to since he did kind of win the match, that surprises me. I mean, I take your word for it. I'm not going to say that you're lying, but I don't know, because they definitely go out of their way to not include Benoit in many of the newer DVDs and the newer content that they have on demand. And in fact, in I don't know if it's on their web. It might be on their website. Maybe somebody can confirm this for me. But when they talk about WrestleMania 20, they actually refer to Undertaker versus Kane as the main event of WrestleMania 20. They don't even acknowledge that there was a triple threat match in the first place with Benoit, Michaels, and Triple H for the title. But the fact that they would refer to Undertaker and Kane as the main event of that show in 04 is just laughable. Because even if you're going to ignore, which it's just so hard to ignore, but let's just say you're going to pretend the Benoit match never happened. The end of WrestleMania never took place. You know, you had other matches on the show that you could say were the main event, more so than Undertaker and Kane, which was actually a shitty match compared to some of the other matches they've had. I mean, you had Kurt Angle defending challenging Eddie Guerrero in a pretty damn good championship match for the WWE belt. I mean, you can call that the main event. You know, you had Goldberg and Brock Lesnar with Steve Austin as the referee, which turned out to be a complete shit match, although it was quite an attraction for all the wrong reasons. But you can even call that a main event more so than Undertaker and Kane. So just pretending it never happened is just completely foolish. But Yeah, no, they're still Benoit is still persona non grata in WWE. If this is true, I'm actually very surprised to hear this. Speaking of which, I may as well mention this now. I forgot to bring this up earlier during Raw. Speaking of pretending matches never happened, apparently Vince McMahon's new doctrine, as of this past week, is the Undertaker versus Triple H match from 10 years ago at WrestleMania 17 in Houston, which I thought was actually a pretty damn good match. In fact, it was one of my favorite matches from WrestleMania that year. And, you know, there were no championships, there were no stipulations, it was just a straight singles match, and it was a damn good one. And Vince's new doctrine is that that match is to not be acknowledged. It is to be as though the match never happened, which is comical to me. Again, I don't know how you can choose to ignore history like that. I don't know why you would not want to acknowledge it and work it, in fact, into the storyline. You know, the fact that Triple H lost once before might actually make people think this time, oh, Triple H ain't going to lose twice to The Undertaker. I mean, Shawn Michaels will lose twice to him, but not Triple H. Or Triple H has never forgotten the loss. And, you know, a decade later, here he is trying to avenge one of his greatest losses at WrestleMania. I mean, again, if I'm Vince McMahon, I try to incorporate it into the storyline. I don't ignore it. I choose to embrace it. People like that. People like history. People like, you know, the whole Punk Orton stuff. You know, acknowledging that it was Orton that cost Punk the championship almost 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago. People like to hear that sort of thing. So, you know, for the people bashing Triple H, I wouldn't be so quick to conclude that it was Triple H who doesn't want people to remember that he lost. This is a Vince McMahon call. It was his decision. It's what he told the announcers. It's what he told Undertaker and Triple H in their promos not to make mention of it. So, it's totally a Vince call. It's not one that I agree with. It's kind of funny. It's kind of stupid. But, again, it's Vince's company, so what the hell are you going to do? Tony writes in. He's got two questions. He's actually new to the website, and he has enjoyed the podcasts, even though he's only heard two of them so far. But apparently, he and I share a lot of the same views. So his first question here says, although WWE in 2010 was sort of lackluster, do you think in 2011 they are trying to get somewhat of an edge back to their material? It may not be on TV-14 levels, but I've seen some edgy stuff of late, and I'm actually liking it because I'm only 22, and I've been a longtime fan of WWE, so I know what they can bring to the table, and it's nice to see. Second question, who would be your opponent, if you can choose one, for The Undertaker at WrestleMania 28? Well, your first question, there is a concerted effort in WWE, it's a Vince McMahon call, as it always is, to push the envelope a little bit more. There's a big difference between pushing the envelope and going full-on TV-14. That's not going to happen. They are TV-PG for the foreseeable future. Again, I fully expect Linda McMahon to run for Senate again next year, and if that happens, not only are they staying TV-PG, but all this edginess that you're seeing, and, you know, The Rock going on TV and calling people a bitch, and John Cena, you know, with his purple pinwheel and his pearl necklace, a lot of this stuff, enjoy it while it lasts. Although, again, I can't get over that pearl necklace thing with Cena. It was so bad. But enjoy this while it lasts, because even this is not going to last all that long. You know, it's being done to promote WrestleMania, and it may continue a little beyond WrestleMania, but, you know, there was a decree that, you know, we need to be a little edgier. We need to push the envelope a little bit more. But, again, they're a PG product. You know, they have this deal with Mattel, which, you know, every time they release their financials every couple of months, it seems like this Mattel deal is the one kind of shining light that they have. I mean, this deal has been a huge deal for them. It was just a phenomenal deal for them to sign. And there's no way that they have an agreement in place with Mattel that would allow them to revert back to being a TV-14 product. It just, you know, for their bottom line, it just doesn't make sense. You know, they're making money on the deal. And just because they, let's say one day they say, you know what, we're going to make Raw TV-14 again. How does that make them more money? It really doesn't change much of anything. So, like I said, enjoy the edginess while it lasts, because it ain't going to last for that much longer. And as far as The Undertaker or WrestleMania 28, I've said it before, I'll say it again, John Cena is the only person at this point that makes sense. Again, unless they can, you know, try to make that Sting match happen next year. John Cena is the only opponent that makes sense that I think people, you know, even a hell of a lot more so than Triple H this year, people will actually believe that perhaps there is a chance the streak could come to an end. I mean, there are people like myself who, it doesn't matter who you put him in the ring with, ain't no way that I'll ever buy into the fact that the streak is going to end. And it shouldn't end. But Cena has, the way the Cena is booked as being Superman most of the time, and the way people react to him and the reaction that he would get during that match, I can guarantee you one thing. I don't know what physical condition Undertaker will be in a year. I don't even know what physical condition he's going to be in at WrestleMania this year. But the one thing I can guarantee you is that you will get a reaction during this match. It will be a passionate reaction. It will likely be a negative reaction for Cena and a positive reaction for The Undertaker. You can book at least one spot during that match where, you know, Cena delivers an attitude adjustment maybe after, you know, a failed attempt earlier in the match and immediately goes for the pin, or he gets Undertaker in the STF, and you could convince people, if booked properly, even if it's just for a few short seconds, to actually think to themselves, holy shit, they're going to put Cena over The Undertaker. And it's that ability, I think, to make people believe that makes Cena the only viable opponent for him at WrestleMania. And it's a match that's been done before, but it's been many, many years since we've seen Undertaker and John Cena. And I know that Undertaker and Cena were actually booked in a match on Raw a couple of years ago, and it only went a couple of minutes. I don't even know. I think it had a fuck finish. You'd have to go back to 2003 or so, when Undertaker was still portraying the American Badass, and he had at least one pay-per-view match with a young John Cena at the time. That's really, you'd have to go all the way back then to find a real program between the two of them. So enough time has gone by where if you want to do that match again, it will feel fresh, because it's not something we've seen a million times, like Cena and Edge, or Cena and Orton, or Undertaker and Kane. So, to me, the only opponent that makes sense for him next year is John Cena. Alex from Tijuana, Mexico writes in. He got a letter on episode 50, episode 100, so I figured I would indulge him and get his letter on episode 150. His question here, about 20 years ago or so, probably a little more than that at this point, there was a pilot episode for a TV show called Tag Team that was filmed. And it was featuring two ex-wrestling superstars turned cops. Starred Rowdy Roddy Piper and Jesse the Body Ventura. There was only one pilot episode filmed and no more. Have I seen this pilot episode? And if so, what did I think of it? And if I could choose two wrestling superstars, who, in my opinion, would make for a good cop show? I have not actually seen the pilot with Piper and Ventura of Tag Team. I remember hearing about it being filmed and reading like older newsletters in recent years from that era. And apparently, the plan was that it would hopefully be a success, it would be picked up, it would be a new, you know, network TV show, and it didn't quite work out that way. I have not seen the pilot episode. As far as two current wrestling stars, you know what? I'm not going to go with two current WWE guys. I will say this. When Kurt Angle and The Big Show were in WWE together, especially when Kurt was doing more comedy stuff, and Big Show, obviously, we know he can do comedy stuff. He's a funny guy. I would love to see Kurt Angle and The Big Show. Again, funny Kurt Angle and funny Big Show on some sort of... It doesn't even have to be a cop show. It could just be some other half-hour, you know, sitcom with two wrestling guys who have to, you know, move in together or some bullshit like that. I just think the comedy potential with those two guys is limitless. I would park myself in front of my television every week and watch that show if they actually made it. Ryan writes in, "You're Solomon, so I've only been listening for a couple of weeks now, but I've been going back through the archives. I heard you talk about how WWE is looking primarily for big guys these days. It makes me think of the conundrum between WWE's wellness policy and looking primarily for big guys. To my understanding, steroids are illegal in WWE. So therefore, how does WWE think these guys get so big? They've got to be looking the other way, so long as their health isn't in any immediate danger. Guys like Triple H or Cena might have great genetics, but you can't deny that they've done or still do steroids. Reminds me of how Arnold Schwarzenegger was campaigning against steroids, but still lends his name and it still lends his name to and supports the Arnold Classic, a bodybuilding show rife with steroid-addled bodies. Well, let's pick this apart here for a second. First of all, you say that guys like Triple H and Cena are either on or have done steroids. Triple H, I don't know what Triple H may or may not be on. I will say this much. Human growth hormone is one thing that there is no reliable test for it. Could a guy like Triple H be on HGH? Sure. Every wrestler on the roster could be on HGH. Now, do I believe that Triple H has done steroids before? Without question. Absolutely. And in fact, I think that has a lot to do with the quad tears that he has suffered in both legs over the years, and among certain other muscle tears that he has sustained. You go look at Triple H in WWF, his physique in 1995, even as late as 1998, and compare it to the way he looked in 2000 when he was ripped to shreds, and he looked his very best in the year 2000. And 2001 is when he first suffered a quad tear. And when he came back from that quad tear in 2002, he was jacked to the gills. I mean, just could barely move. And even at other times over the years, it looked like he kind of maybe was off steroids, got a little pudgy. Keep in mind, he's also had a couple of kids. And many times in the past, you know, Randy Savage is another example of this. I remember reading that, you know, when, you know, at one point Savage and Elizabeth were trying to have children together. And that's around the time that Savage, I think, lost at WrestleMania 7 and stopped wrestling, and his physique changed. Because guys knew that if you're going to try to have kids, you got to get off the gas, because it could have, you know, it could result in potential birth defects. I'm not saying that's why Triple H got pudgy at certain points over the last couple of years. It's just, you know, something to keep in mind. And then he would be pudgy, and then all of a sudden Triple H would be, you know, ripped again. And it could just be the result of working out, but do I believe Triple H has done steroids before? Absolutely, without question. I have two functioning, working eyeballs, and that's all I need to determine that. And, you know, I even remember a radio interview that Triple H did many, many years ago, maybe as late as a decade ago, and the subject of steroids came up, and I remember reading a transcript of this interview. And Triple H, without coming out and saying that he likes steroids or that he supports them, was doing his damnedest to defend them, and to defend it light doses or using them responsibly, I should say. He wasn't turning around and giving the typical response of, oh, you know, I don't do steroids, we don't support steroids, steroids are bad for you. If anything, it was almost like he was arguing for how they could be supportive. And there is an argument to be had that certain steroids in either low doses or, you know, doctor-approved doses could be beneficial to one's health. Now, as far as Cena is concerned, say what you want to about Cena. And Cena did do bodybuilding early on before he became a pro wrestler. And if you go back and find photos online on Google of John Cena back during his young bodybuilding days, I find it incredibly difficult to believe that even with great genetics, which I'm sure Cena has, that you can get any sort of real bodybuilding physique like that without some sort of chemical assistance. Having said that, Cena has never failed a steroid test. Cena has been adamant that he doesn't do steroids, and he's never done steroids. If I'm Cena, I don't know that I would say that I've never done them. I would just say that I don't currently do them. But either way, we don't have any proof of that. Now, what I mean when I say that Vince McMahon and WWE are looking for primarily big guys, or they're looking for guys that are 6'2 and above, I'm not talking necessarily about jacked up physiques. Now, don't get me wrong, you've got a guy like a Mason Ryan who comes along, and the first thing they notice about him is his physique. But what I mean when I say big guys, I'm talking about literally big guys. Guys that are tall, guys that are in good shape, but they're just naturally big people. They're 6'3", they're 6'6", they're 250 pounds. I'm not saying all of these guys have the ripped, shredded, jacked physiques. I just mean they're big guys. It might just mean height-wise. You know, you could have a guy that has an average physique, but he's in good shape and he's 6'8". That's what WWE is looking for. I'm not talking about jacked physiques. I'm not saying they're, in that respect, they're turning a blind eye to steroids. So don't get me wrong. When I say big guys, I'm not talking about Batista-looking big guys necessarily. I just mean guys that are of a certain weight and a certain height. You know, they're not looking for guys, even if you have a guy who's ripped and shredded, if he's 5'8", that's probably not somebody that Vince McMahon is going to have a whole hell of a lot of interest in. And there are exceptions to that. You know, they just signed Sin Cara, who they're hoping is a modern-day version of Rey Mysterio, and Sin Cara ain't 6 feet tall. But he's the exception, not the rule. You know, he's a big star in Mexico that they threw a lot of money at. They understand that they need a return on their investment, so they're going to go all the way with this guy, and they're going to promote him, and they know that Rey Mysterio is not going to be around forever. So in the case of Sin Cara, the former Mystico, that's why they signed him, and they're pushing him. How many Sin Caras do you think Vince McMahon is actually going to go out and sign? Not very many. So don't misconstrue when I say big guys. I'm not saying jacked up physiques. I just mean literally big guys. And that can mean a variety of different things. Got a letter here from Ecolanth. He writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I realized while watching Raw that while the streak for The Undertaker is at 18-0... and more than likely 19-0 after WrestleMania this year, the announcer said The Undertaker has beaten 18 people, when technically that isn't true. To my knowledge, he has faced 15 people, with 3 matches against Kane and 2 against Shawn Michaels. The number of people he has fought will not go up this year either, since he already fought Triple H." Well, don't tell Vince McMahon that, but yes, you are correct. Well, you know, when they say that, they're referring to not 18 different people per se, they're just saying 18 people. So, like, in other words, you know, Kane at WrestleMania 14, Kane at WrestleMania 20, same person, yes, but still, he, you know, it counts in their mind as another number. In terms of actual different people, you are correct. I believe that number is about 15 or so. I know at WrestleMania 19, he was in a handicap match against 2 people. I believe that was Big Show and A-Train. And if he beats Triple H this year, that number, as you said, will not go up. So, all the more reason to get him in there with Cena. Cena would be a fresh number for him to face at WrestleMania. Chris Foster writes into the Sound Off here. He's been listening since episode 126. His question is, which WrestleMania was better, in my opinion, WrestleMania 17 or 18? I think they're both up there for top contenders for best of all time, but out of these two, which one is your favorite and why, and which one was your favorite matches from both? WrestleMania 17 is the easy winner. WrestleMania 17, probably one of the, if not the best WrestleMania from top to bottom of all time, and there really is no comparison there. As far as my favorite matches from each, WrestleMania 17 had a lot of good matches. I just said this earlier. Undertaker Triple H was a very good match. Kurt Angle Chris Benoit was a very good match. TLC 2 was probably my favorite TLC matches out of all of them. Austin and Rock had their best WrestleMania match ever. You know, and they had some pretty good WrestleMania matches, but their best one was from WrestleMania 17. It was a great main event. Vince and Shane McMahon, I give them all the credit in the world. As a match, it wasn't anything special, but as an attraction from start to finish and the stuff with Linda McMahon towards the end that the people went apeshit for, it was a spectacle, and it turned out to be a really great match overall. My favorite match from WrestleMania 17, for nostalgia purposes, was probably the Gimmick Battle Royal, which was an absolutely atrocious match, and it only went about 5 minutes, if that. But aside from the Gimmick Battle Royal, if I had to pick a match, I would probably go with TLC 2. Edge and Christian, the Hardys and the Dudleys. You had a cameo appearance from Spike Dudley, Lita, and Rhino, who all interfered, but the interference didn't hurt the match. If anything, it helped the match. And, you know, to this day, I'll never forget that spot midway through the match where, Jeff Hardy was going for the championship belts. He's hanging now. He's hanging from the cable that is holding the titles. And you have all these ladders set up in the ring, and Edge climbs one of the tall ladders, and he delivers a spear on Jeff Hardy from all the way up there. I mean, those guys must have fallen 15 feet. It was just amazing. It was an amazing thing to witness. It's one of those all-time highlight reel spots in WrestleMania history. That probably was my favorite overall match on that show. As far as WrestleMania 18 is concerned, a fine show, but nothing close top to bottom to what WrestleMania 17 was. But my favorite match, obviously, was Hulk Hogan and The Rock. I mean, the magic that those two guys were able to build in that match is unparalleled. I mean, I literally got goosebumps during that match, and I can't tell you that, you know, that's happened too many times, where I'm actually so into what I'm watching that I have goosebumps on my arms. And, you know, I grew up a Hogan fan, as you know, back in the day, and I'm sure nostalgia played a big part of it, but the crowd was the real winner. The real star of that match was the audience, who, you know, 60-something thousand people in the Sky Dome, where Hogan lost to the Warrior at WrestleMania 6 in 1990. People never forgot that. And The Rock came in as the babyface. Hogan was the heel. The fans said, fuck that. We want Hogan as the babyface. Rock is the heel. And Rock was a total pro in this match. He just went with it. He went with the flow. He didn't get flustered. He played his role perfectly to a T. They had the spot in the match where Hogan hulked up, and the place just went bonkers. And you had that great near fall where Hogan gave Rock the leg drop. Everybody and their mother believed that Hogan was going to win, and he didn't. And it was a good thing that he didn't. It was the right thing. Rock should have won, and he did. And then, of course, they did the NWO beatdown after the match, and that was the beginning of the end for the NWO in WWE. But there's no match on that card that comes close. Undertaker and Ric Flair had a pretty good match. And my favorite, my second favorite spot of the entire show, aside from the Hogan hulk-up in his match with Rock, was the spot towards the end of Undertaker-Flair where Arn Anderson did a run-in and delivered just a fantastic-looking spine buster. I mean, Anderson ran into that ring, and again, he's been retired for a number of years due to injuries and I think nerve damage that he sustained as a result of a botched operation. But Arn Anderson slid into that ring and delivered a spine buster that few people can deliver the way that he does. And it was a great, 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 great spot. Triple H and Jericho had a very disappointing main event match. Even Jericho in his book talks about how disappointing it really was. The crowd was not all that into it. They were just completely exhausted from the Hogan Rock match earlier. And even Jericho in his book says that match should have gone on last, not ours. People came to see Hogan and Rock. They didn't come to see this match. And I cannot remember too many other matches in that show. Kurt Angle and Kane, who I remember having a great match on SmackDown a couple of months before WrestleMania. So they had some good chemistry together, but whatever, their match at WrestleMania, for whatever reason, was not good. And in fact, I think there was a roll-up for a finish in that match when Angle won, and I think they botched it. So that wasn't a particularly good match, and there was a four-way, if I remember, for the tag team titles that I think Billy and Chuck won, and I can't remember too many other matches from that show. So WrestleMania 17, the clear winner, as far as the two shows are concerned. Brandon from Las Vegas writes in, he's been listening to the Sound Off since episode 112. Question about the Shawn Michaels Hulk Hogan match from SummerSlam 2005, where Shawn completely oversold all of Hogan's move. I personally thought it was pretty funny. What did you think of this match, and what was the reason behind Shawn's actions? I thought the match was pretty good. It was all Shawn Michaels. I mean, Shawn totally carried Hogan in that match, but the crowd was into it. That SummerSlam did something like between 500,000 and 600,000 buys, which would make it, I don't know where it would rank overall, maybe number 4 or 5 all time, perhaps. But I know that SummerSlam pay-per-view buy rate-wise performed better than almost any other non-WrestleMania pay-per-view in WWE history. And you can credit that mostly to Hogan, but as far as the match is concerned, it was all Shawn Michaels. I mean, Hogan did what he could do. He bled a gusher in that match. You know, he worked as hard as he could, given his deteriorating physical condition. The reason Shawn oversold all those moves was, I think, part of it may have been because he knew that he couldn't get a great match out of Hogan, so he had to compensate for that by overselling. But I think the bigger part of it was that Michaels was very upset. Not even so much that he had to do the job to Hogan, but because Michaels' idea was to do a two-match series on pay-per-view with Hogan. They would have a match at SummerSlam, and they would have a rematch inside of a steel cage the following month at what I believe would have been Unforgiven. And I think he was fine with Hogan going over at, or rather, I think Michaels wanted to go over at SummerSlam, and Hogan would get the win back, I think, at the next pay-per-view. I think that was the idea. And Hogan, who, of course, in his contract has a clause that allows for 100% creative control over his matches and storylines, decided, you know what? Not only is there not going to be a second match, but I'm going to win this one. In fact, I think Hogan wanted to win both matches, and when he knew that wasn't going to happen, he decided there is going to be no second match, and I'm winning at SummerSlam, end of story, and I'm winning clean with the leg drop, which is exactly what happened. He had the power to call for that as a finish. You can blame Vince McMahon and WWE for that if you want, for giving him the power to do that. And Michaels knew this, and Michaels was not happy about it. And I think part of it was to make Hogan look bad. Especially on that last big boot before he gave Michaels the leg drop. Hogan gave Michaels the big boot, and instead of just taking a bump and falling down, Michaels popped back up. He ran around in a circle like three times, and then he plopped down on the mat. And it was hilarious, but again, this is your pay-per-view main event. This was not meant to be taken as a joke, and even though it was very funny. You could find videos all over YouTube of highlights of the Michaels-Hogan match set to the theme from Benny Hill, and it's actually quite hilarious. And it's also the reason why on Raw the next night, Michaels came out to do a promo, and he made a comment about Hogan. He made a snide remark about Hulk Hogan as kind of one last dig. A little unprofessional, but clearly he was still very much bothered by what happened. And you know what? I have no sympathy for Shawn Michaels. I love Shawn Michaels as a performer. I think he did a fantastic job. But you know what? Once upon a time, for all the stuff that people can say about Hogan and his politics, we've known about that for years and years, going back to not even WCW, but even his first run in the WWF. Hogan is a master politician. Shawn Michaels, even though the second half of his career was very much different from the first half, Michaels was known for creating more than some problems in his initial run in the World Wrestling Federation, and for being a bit of a politician himself. And all that happened here is that you had a battle between two politicians, and one politician lost, and one politician won. So, again, Shawn coming out on Raw the next night and saying what he said about Hogan was just, it was unprofessional, it was stupid, it was just, he should have just moved on, and that's why he did what he did. Daniel writes in, formerly he was Pride from the now defunct SC Scoops message board. He mentions the same thing I mentioned earlier. You know, you have Kelly, who was fired from SmackDown on February 11th. She's now back. You have Dolph Ziggler, who was fired from SmackDown on February 18th. He's now back. You have Vicky Guerrero, who was fired from SmackDown on February 25th. She's at least back for now. Nobody was fired from SmackDown, but Alex Riley was recently fired from Raw in the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure we'll see him back in no time. So that's 4 weeks in a row that somebody was fired from WWE programming. Do I think someone will get fired on Friday SmackDown this past week, which would make it 5 weeks in a row? Well, I guess now that SmackDown is in the books, we can safely say that nobody got fired this past week. So I guess that's a plus. All right, let's do about two more here. Rob writes in, so thanks to last week's mailbag, I decided to check out the Steiner Mania clips on YouTube. Hilarious stuff. While watching them, I was reminded of something that has always bugged me about Scott Steiner's physique. I thought perhaps you could shed some more light on this. What the hell happened to Scott Steiner's chest? Even during his run in WCW, I noticed that he started developing this gap in his pectoral muscles, right where they meet at the sternum, and it's gotten more prominent over the years, the gap, that is. I've checked online, and people have said that it's probably due to excessive steroid use or that he tore his pec muscles and they've not healed properly. I was wondering if you had heard anything different. I have not heard anything about Scott Steiner's pecs. Could it be the result of steroid use or abuse? Sure, but I tend to believe the second reason, which is probably that he suffered at least one torn pec muscle and it didn't heal properly, or it didn't completely heal at all. That will sometimes result in either like a deformed-looking pec muscle or a weird gap between the two. And I know that Chris Masters, who of course is still on the SmackDown brand, he tore his pec a couple of years ago, and I think to this day his pecs look a little weird, or I think one looks a little bit different than the other. Perhaps somebody wants to go and study his pecs. I choose not to do that, but I think Chris Masters is in a similar situation, or at least he was. Maybe now his pecs are perfectly healed. But I tend to believe that's probably what it was. And lastly here, Tony writes in, "Dear Solo Monster, wanted to ask you two questions here. How did the Sound Off come into existence, and what made you want to start it? Just curious. I think I've told the story before. It's pretty basic. You know, Webmaster Mike started SE Scoop several years ago. He had a vision for what he wanted it to be. And so he came to me and he said, listen, you know, I need some assistance here. We need some fresh content for the website instead of just posting news. Would you be willing to contribute in some way? And, of course, I said I was most definitely willing to help out in any way that I could. So I started doing some editorials and stuff, and then I was asked to do an audio show. And hence the Sound Off was born. It was November of 2007. I did the first show. I expected to do maybe a couple of them and then see where it goes. And, of course, you know, 150 episodes later, here I am still doing it. So that's kind of how the whole thing started. It was a favor to a friend, and it was not something I had planned on doing, but I'm happy I did do it because I enjoy doing it. I've built up a nice audience for myself. A lot of people listen to the show every week, and if they get some level of enjoyment out of it, then it's all worth it for me. So that's how it got started. And actually, I mean, I had done some radio stuff before. Actually, during the Attitude Era in the late 90s, I was recruited. I cannot even remember how. I don't know what I was doing, but somebody took note of me or my opinions, and they asked me to appear on a segment called Shumi Shivani. This was on a radio show at a college station in, I believe it was Boulder, Colorado. This would have been around 98 or so. And I would call in, and I became the newsman on this guy's show, where I would deliver the wrestling news and talk about different things that were going on. And then a couple of years later, this would have been around 2002, I had called in for a couple of different segments. Another friend of mine who worked at a radio station, and it wasn't a wrestling show, but wrestling was still kind of popular at the time, and they were casual wrestling fans. They weren't as big, you know, my friend and the person he did the show with were not as big into wrestling as they once were, but they asked if I would come on one time and talk about wrestling and talk about the news, and I did it, and it turned into a thing where I did it several more times. As a matter of fact, now that I think about it, it was on WRMU in Ohio that I called in. And I actually taped some of those shows. I have some of them. I have at least two of those shows recorded in MP3 format. So who knows? If there's an interest in people wanting to listen to those old segments, email me and let me know. Maybe I can edit them, and maybe I'll upload them as vintage shows. Pre-Sound Off, vintage Solomonster shows. It might be interesting, actually, for me to go back and listen to these things since they were recorded in 2002. And so that probably means I was talking a lot of the time about Triple H's comeback at the Rumble, and let's see, the NWO was first coming in, so it might be interesting to go back and listen to those shows. So yeah, email me and let me know if you'd be interested to listen to those. So that's going to do it for this week. I got a lot of other questions I didn't get to. I understand that. I'm going to try to respond to people directly, and if I didn't get to your question on the show this week, I promise I will try to get to it next week on episode 151. Keep emailing me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter. We're over 740 followers and counting at twitter.com/Solomonster. It's where I gave all my updates during my little vacation. I couldn't post on Facebook, so I just posted everything on Twitter. And you can get me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Keep spreading the good word of the Sound Off. I appreciate it, as always. Let all your friends and family know. We even have a famous baseball player, apparently, who has taken an interest in the Sound Off. I won't say anything more than that, but that's kind of cool to hear. We'll be back next week with episode 151 of the Sound Off right here on SEScoops.com. So, as always, be well, stay safe, take it easy, and we'll see you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.